introduced a concept car called the Volt. Rather than begin mass production of the Volt, because you think, well, this is a good idea. I mean, a car that primarily runs on electricity, and for people that do short commutes, that they'll virtually never have to put gas in it. Why don't they just start putting it out immediately, and let's take advantage of this great idea? Well, they had to test it. They had to see what it was really made of before they put it into production. Some of the most recent tests, they've gone through nearly 4 years of rigorous testing now with this Chevy Volt. Some of the most recent tests have been in Yuma, Arizona. The reason they put it out there is because Yuma, Arizona is really, really hot. And there's areas out there that are really, really dusty. And they're putting this car through the desert heat to see how this new electric system and the fuel system and the car itself and everything holds up to the test of the heat that's put on it, even the interior design and so forth. They have run it through tests where they drive it behind a pickup for miles on dirt roads. So it's sitting behind this big cloud of dust for miles on end, and then they test to see where dust gets in and what it does to the components of the vehicle and the filters and all this type of thing. They're running it through a lot of tests there in the desert. They test the drivetrain for stress. They test for reliability. Why didn't they just let it go immediately and start saving all this money on fuel? The Volt has to be tried. It has to be tested before it's released. You may remember the Chevy's ad slogan between 1986 and 1992 was Chevy, the heartbeat of America. Now, it's not the slogan for Chevy anymore, but right now when they're going through the testing of the Volt, they're testing the heart of the Volt. I read on greensupply.com, talking about green things, and they think that Volt is kind of a green vehicle. And they say this about the Volt. They say it's battery technology, the heart of the Volt, needs to be the car's greatest innovation, and it had best not skip a beat. Put the car out there without testing the heart of the Volt, and it fails, Chevy has wasted millions and millions of dollars in putting this car out. People who end up purchasing a $40,000 Volt will be glad that it's been tested. As with the testing involved in any area of life, we have to go through certain tests to be tried and tested. Mike was talking about that. Forgot your last name. I'm old. DeSoto. Talked about testing last week. The testing of those who will inherit the kingdom of God is of vital importance. No more than you would want to buy a car that had just been thrown into production without testing. God doesn't want you a part of his kingdom until we have been tested. So testing is a part of the process. Jeremiah chapter 17, verse 10. This is, look into God's mind and see what he's looking for. See what he wants out of each and every individual one of us. Jeremiah 17, 10, after saying the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked, it says, I, the Lord, search the heart and examine the mind. It's like that Volt's going through this exhaustive testing. God is going through a testing of my heart and my mind and your heart and your mind. To reward a man according to his conduct, according to what his deeds deserve. What we have in our heart is what we will do. And so he wants to see what's in here, to see what we're going to do, not just now, but when we become eternal beings in the kingdom, we got to be tested. God put Israel through a desert testing ground, a desert proving ground, just like the volt was out to Yuma. Deuteronomy chapter 8 and verse 2. Deuteronomy chapter 8 and verse 2. You read the Bible back here and you say, wow, those guys had to go through a lot of stuff. And it wasn't very pleasant a lot of times. In fact, it was extremely unpleasant at different times. Why did God have them go through that? Well, let God tell us. Deuteronomy 8 and verse 2, he says, "And you shall remember that the Lord your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and to test you, so that he could know what's in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not." And so God is testing each and every one of us to see what's in our heart. How are we going to respond to this test? How are we going to respond to the dust test and the heat test and all of those things that come upon us at one time or the other with one test or the other? He wants to know what's in here, because apparently he just doesn't know automatically. You know, I called this person. They're a part of my body of Christ. Once saved, always saved. You gave your heart to the Lord. And you don't give your heart to the Lord until it's been tested and he knows what's in that heart. And if it's not what he wants, he says, keep it. And he says he wants to see whether you would keep his commandments or not. You know, it says the greatest of these commandments is love. So some of the tests that we're going to receive is to see what's in our heart, to see if we have God's mind in our hearts. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, and I know I've said this before, and I'll say it a bunch of times again as long as I have the power and ability and authority to speak. This, to me, is one of the most significant scriptures in the Bible, because it tells us that all these things are for you and for me, that there's a purpose to them. And there's a lesson to learn from each individual story that's in the Bible, each individual example that's there. And it's not just a nice thing to read and say, oh, how sweet. You know, I just love reading the Word of God. Even when it corrects, we should. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 11, after speaking of the children of Israel coming out of out of Egypt into the wilderness and that trip to the promised land, he says, "These things happened to them as examples and are written down as warnings for us upon whom the fulfillment of the ages has come." And Paul, through God's inspiration, is telling us that, look, when you read one of those things in the Old Testament, and I say, obviously, the New too, he says, those things are written for you. I believe we're at the end of the age, whatever that means. You know, whether it's 5 years or 50 years, it's still the end of the age. And it's for you, and it's for me. And if we don't take the things in there and say, here's a story, what can I learn from it? As an individual, what can we learn collectively? But, you know, when you start talking, what can we learn collectively, then you start saying, well, that belongs to them. That's their responsibility. No, what does God want of me? What can I learn from this story? And a lot of times we look at that and say, well, but they were carnal Israel. You know, they didn't have God's Spirit. They weren't baptized. They just went through the symbolism of baptism through the sea. But we've got God's Spirit, so we're better than that. I think time is proving that we have our problems too. We don't always behave the way that we know we ought to behave and react the way we ought to react. So Paul then says, lest we think, hey, this story doesn't apply to me. He says, so if you think you are standing firm, be careful that you don't fall. King James says, let he who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. So the things that we're going to talk about today are not for any one group of people or any one person. According to Scripture here, that we all need to look as are warnings for all of us upon whom the ends of the age are come. Today I want to go back to one of those incidents that is written, as God says, as a warning for us and see what we can learn. Most members are familiar with the story of Korah, the K word, the big K word, Korah. Now, in the church, we tend to use the story of Korah and the K word, you're a Korah, when someone doesn't agree with us. You know, it's basically like, you have the spirit of Korah because you don't agree with me and God. You know, and so you have the spirit of Korah. People in authority have used this to beat people up over the head with it and say, because you don't agree with me, you have the spirit of Korah. You don't do as I say, you have the spirit of rebellion. You know, and people have misused it. And because people have misused it, does it mean there's not a lesson in there for us? He who thinks he stands, take heed, lest he fall. And of course, the story of Korah has been used in, you know, in the church oftentimes. It's, well, you have the spirit of Korah. No, you have the spirit of Korah. And I got God on my side. No, you've got the spirit of Korah, and I've got God on my side. And then people throw it back and forth. So it can be a little of a turnoff at times. But let's not say it's just an Old Testament thing that can have no application. Just because there's no Moses today. And I don't believe there is a Moses today, and you're rebelling against this one individual or whatever. But on the other hand, Jesus said the scribes and Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. The scribes or Pharisees, whichever one it was. And so there's kind of there's a principle involved that I think we can all learn from. You know, with all the upset and disturbances in the Church of God at this time, many people are rushing to jump on one bandwagon or on another, and some people are making mistakes with it. And I just want to address that today, just to help us to examine this and say, am I sure I'm right? Or might I look at it from another perspective? Whatever your perspective is, whatever my perspective is, it's for each and individual, every individual one of us. Numbers chapter 16 and 17 contain some major principles we need to learn today. I'm not here to say that any, you know, this person or that group or whatever are Korah and somebody else is Moses or whatever, but there are principles to learn today. Let's look at a little background. The children of Israel, of course, had come out of Egypt, had been wandering in the wilderness for a little while here, and there had been a number of inconveniences that the children of Israel had gone through. And I would say the word inconveniences, they would probably scoff at that and say, understatement, you know. One of the major contentions at that time involved the home office move. It's like, we're here in the wilderness, and we want to move to the promised land. You know, we're going to relocate to Jerusalem or whatever. I'm not trying to make a promise. I'm not trying to make any analogies between the home office move and things. It's just that nothing changes. You know, the principles are still the same. Items of contention arise, okay? And in principle, they can apply in a lot of ways, because you got people saying, well, anybody that was against the home office move is a Korah, and, you know, and all this. I don't want to go there. But just to point out that things don't change that much. Numbers chapter 14, you know, they went in to spy out the land, and 10 guys came back and said, not a suitable place, not a good place to go. We're not going. And a couple of guys says, yeah, I think we ought to. And God went with the majority. It's kind of interesting, isn't it? That here was a majority that God went with and said, well, okay, you don't want to go? You're not going. Okay. God sometimes lets us do what we want to do. There were some penalties for it. Before we move on into the story of Korah, what were the names of the guys that were with Korah that are recorded? What was it? Don't look. Just out of memory, what was it? What's that? I said don't look. You're cheating. Okay, so who was it that was with Korah? Dathan and Abiram. And on. Numbers chapter 16. Let's go ahead and turn over there. Numbers chapter 16. I'll begin reading this from the New Century Version in verse 1. It says, Korah, Dathan, Abiram, and On turned against Moses. I've been in the church for literally 50 years. And whenever I've referred to this story, I say, Korah, Dathan, Abiram. I've never used Korah, Dathan, Abiram, and On. Until I began looking at this a little closer and said, oh, okay, there's this guy named On. Okay. Let's, again, looking at background, it defines this a little closer because there's something that we need to notice in here. He says, Korah was the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, son of Levi. Okay, that's important to the story. And so is this. Dathan and Abiram were brothers, the sons of Eliab, and On was the son of Peleth. Dathan, Abiram, and On were from the tribe of Reuben. It's also important to the story. Verse 2, these men gathered 250 other Israelite men. Now, how do you gather people? Well, you talk to them and you tell them why it is you're gathering them there and what your beef is and why they ought to think the way you think, and we're pulling these guys all together here. And, I mean, they weren't like bad guys. Verse 2, these men gathered 250 men of Israel, well-known leaders chosen by the community. I like this guy. He's a guy after my own heart. I like the way he does stuff. I like the way he thinks. He's a very nice person. He's always served my family. You know, he's got really good characteristics. And then they challenged Moses. Verse 3, it says, they came as a group to speak to Moses and Aaron and said, you have gone too far. All the people are holy, every one of them. And the Lord is among them. So why do you put yourselves above all the people of the Lord? Now, it's easy for us to look at this story and draw conclusions because we have the conclusion written, don't we? You know, we can close the Bible and say, I know what happened to these guys. That God, like, took them out because he wasn't happy with them. So all I need to know about the story of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram is that God didn't like it, and so we've got a judgment that we can make here. Because we know God's perspective. But what if you were back there? Go back in time. Were you there in the wilderness? You were denied access to the promised land and told you're going to have to wait another 40 years and most of you are not going to make it because of some things you've done and your kids will make it. But here you are and you're in the camp of Israel. And this stuff starts happening. And you're an innocent person in the congregation. and you're getting different sides of the story. And you're gathering these sides of the story. Let's go on and take a look at the dynamics to see if you're going to evaluate this circumstance, not knowing the end, not knowing how God's going to handle this, but before. Let's look at some of these facts. Korah was a Levite, as we just read. His grandfather was Kohath. Not insignificant, because Numbers chapter 4, verse 4 says, "This is the work of the Kohathites in the tent meeting, the care of the most holy things." God gave Kohathites, the sons of Kohath, a job. And that job was to go in the temple there, the tabernacle, in the meeting place, and you take care of the most holy things. Now, what if you were given that job? What do you do? Oh, I care for the most holy things, because God gave me that job. Knowing human nature, I think if God had given me that job and I think I'm over the most holy things, I think, pretty good guy, okay? Otherwise, why would he have chosen me? Numbers 4, verse 17, it says, "Then the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, 'Do not let the Kohathite clans be destroyed from the Levites.'" They're very important to me. They're special to me. Don't let them be destroyed. And one way you're going to keep them from being destroyed is they got certain rules about going in the tabernacle, and they need to follow them, and here's what I want you to do. Verse 19, "This is what you must do so they will live and not die when they approach the most sacred objects over which I give them charge. Aaron and his sons must always go in with them and assign a specific duty or load to each person." I'm over the holy things, and you got to send them in to try to tell me my job? I mean, I'm perfectly capable of doing this job without Aaron and his sons telling me what to do. I think I ought to be able to go in and just do my job, and you leave me alone. Who are you to tell me what to do? And it says, verse 20, "The Kohathites must never enter the sanctuary to look at the sacred objects, even for a moment, or they will die." So the Kohathites had a very prestigious job, and Korah was a Kohathite. Very important person. VIP. Dathan, Abiram, and On, it said, were Reubenites. Who is Reuben? What's that? Firstborn of the Israelites. Firstborn of Israel. In Genesis 49, I'll just read it for you, but in Genesis 49, verse 3, Israel is giving a blessing. And this is what he says. He says, Genesis 49, verse 3, New King James Version says, "Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength." And finishing up this blessing, New Century Version, or the next part of this blessing, it says, "You have the highest position among my sons. You are the most powerful. Reuben, you're my firstborn." Who received the blessings in Israel back at that time? Who the first, when the old guy died, who got the shot as the first? The firstborn. Okay. He had the power. Now, it was taken away from him because of certain actions that he did that were improper. But, I mean, that was Reuben, and we ought to have, a little preeminence here. I mean, Reuben had that blessing and said, "You have the highest position among my sons." So Korah, the Levite, Kohathite, Dathan, Abiram, On, Reubenites. And then there were 250 men. And it was stated that they were well-respected men of character, good personalities, respected among the congregation. Oh, again, you might wonder, well, how did these people all get together? Well, you start with one guy talking to another guy. Or one guy talking to three other guys, sounds like Korah, Dathan, Abiram, and On, and said, there's some stuff wrong here. And we shouldn't have to put up with that. And then they started talking to some other guys. Now we say, we got the internet today, and we got information overload and internet. They had it better than we do. Because they were in the same congregation. They weren't like miles away where they had to go and get the internet. They were right there, and so they'd sit around the tents at night and they'd talk to one another. Really good communication, if you will. And so people are sitting around talking with one another, and what are they saying? Well, the Bible specifically says some of the things that they were saying, and others we can fill in a little bit. But let's say that you're in Israel right now. Again, you don't know the end of the story. You just know that Korah, Dathan, Abiram, and On, very well-respected, 250 really well-respected guys are out there. And they say, you're sitting around the tent, a few of them, and they say, you remember back about four chapters ago? Do you remember what happened in Numbers 12? This Moses. Numbers 12, verse 1, just something that I would presume they would be talking about. Numbers 12, verse 1, it says, then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married, for he had married an Ethiopian woman. Now, I don't know what the problem was with marrying the Ethiopian woman, what they were standing on as far as principle and so forth, but there was something he had done, and he had done it. And it was such that it was not a good example. He didn't marry within Israel. He married outside of Israel. And if you're going to keep Israelites Israelites, well, then you go and marry an Ethiopian woman. And Moses, you're setting a horrible example. I don't know what all circumstances are behind this, but that's what they said. Had he done it? Yeah. Was it wrong? Apparently so. I mean, God never says, no, it's all right. It wasn't a problem. It just says, yeah, he did it, but. And so, because he had made, given a bad example, so they said, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also? You remember Moses when I, of course you don't remember because you were too young, when I took you down to the sea and into the bulrushes and I floated you down there. I changed your diapers, Moses. I know you. I know what kind of kid you were when you grew up. And Aaron says, who's been doing all the talking here? I mean, who did God use to do this talking? Well, it was me. Okay? So they're talking about Moses. Even his relatives recognize the problem. And you don't think that was going around camp? Hey, remember, when Miriam and Aaron were even after Moses for what he was doing? I mean, even they recognize that the guy has some problems. Well, there are more problems in the administration because Moses set an unqualified family member to be up over some other people. I mean, you think about it. Remember, you're in Israel now. You're not just looking at it from God's perspective and saying, well, I'm glad I am on that side now. They're sitting around talking and say, you guys remember when Moses went up to the mountain to get the Ten Commandments? Who built the golden calf? His name was Aaron, wasn't it? Okay, now you think about it. Aaron was the one that built the golden calf. And Aaron is the one that tells me what to do when I go into the holy place. Does it make sense? And I think that the Korah, Dathan, Abiram, and On, and 250 people there could say, we didn't even worship that golden calf. Because they didn't get swallowed up, did they? They weren't around there worshiping that golden calf, so they were the good guys in this whole thing. Aaron was a bad guy. You tell me he wasn't. He built the golden calf, his own hands. You don't think he had something that people could talk about and say, okay, there's something wrong here. And then, you know, who does Moses set up over him? We got nepotism. His brother, of course. You know, he gives a brother the job, and he's obviously not qualified. And Moses claims that God set Aaron over the Kohathites. But you show me that, other than where it says God showed Moses and Aaron. I mean, that was executive session. I don't want anybody there to prove that Aaron's supposed to be over Korah. Show it to me. Prove it. We're just going by what Moses said and what Aaron says. And then there's this whole promised land thing. You know, he claims he's going to set us free and bring us to the promised land. And now what? We got to wander around this stupid place for 40 years and we're all going to die, except for our kids. I think Moses is the wrong guy for the job. I mean, honestly, do you not think you might have been caught up a little bit in that? I do expect I would have. Because it's a bunch of bad stuff. Let's continue with the story. Numbers chapter 16. And they united, verse 3, Numbers 16, verse 3, New Living Translation says, they united against Moses and Aaron and said, you have gone too far. The whole community of Israel has been set apart by the Lord, and he's with all of us. What right do you have to act as though you are greater than the rest of the Lord's people? As though there's some issue of authority or government here. I mean, that's a non-issue. You shouldn't be setting yourself up over us. Well, let's notice Moses' reaction as God's appointed. And I think this is important too. Numbers chapter 16 and verse 4. Today's English version says, when Moses heard this, he threw himself on the ground and prayed. You know, when you're challenged, when your authority is challenged, when your integrity is challenged, what do we like to do? I'll tell them who's in charge. They think they're in charge. You're going to see who's in charge. He threw himself on the ground and he humbled himself. Now, the Bible talks about Moses being the most humble guy. This is one reason. He was in a position of humility, not challenge. It wasn't, I'm going to meet them head on. I'm going to show them who's in charge. Very good example for a leader. Okay, this whole story is not just about the leadees. It's also about the leaders on how God would have us to do things. Numbers chapter 16 and verse 5. It said, and then he said to Korah and all his followers, and so he had a meeting with them. And he said, in the morning the Lord will show who belongs to him and who's holy, and he'll have that person come near to him, the man he chooses. He will cause to come near to him. You, Korah, and all your followers are to do this. Take censers, and tomorrow put fire and incense in them before the Lord, and the man the Lord chooses will be the one who is holy. The Levites have gone too far. Now, the accusation was against Moses having gone too far with his authority. And Moses said, I want you to reconsider things. That maybe, just maybe you've gone a little too far in your judgment of things. And maybe you're making some mistakes. He says, God will let it be known. I don't have to do it. You don't have to do it. God, in his time, and it will be the next day here, he'll let it be known. So God will handle this thing. We go on to verse 8, and Moses said to Korah, "Listen, you Levites, isn't it enough for you that the God of Israel has separated you from the rest of the Israelite community and brought you near to himself to do the work at the Lord's tabernacle and stand before the community and minister to them?" He says, guys, let's think about the privilege of serving God's people and the privilege of serving God. And he says, you know, our jobs here are not, I'm over the holy things. The job is the holy things will serve the people. And he's having these leaders assess themselves and say, why am I here and what am I doing? What is my purpose for God giving me the blessing and the benefit of being able to do this? Is it to make me great? Is it to show people how good I am? Or is it just to serve the people? And Moses is saying, look, just isn't it enough? Verse 10, he's brought you and your fellow Levites near to himself. What a blessing to be called. But then we get off on this other stuff. But now you're trying to get the priesthood too. God gave you this over the holy things, but he didn't make you the one that oversees you to do that. That was Aaron's job. And now you want Aaron's job too. He says, it is against the Lord that you and your followers have banded together. Who is Aaron that you should grumble against him? Well, we know who Aaron was and should grumble against him. He's his brother and the guy that built the golden calf. And probably a whole bunch of other things we could say. Remember, it was Moses, it was Aaron that a couple of chapters ago went after you also, Moses. So what's the big deal? If you're there at that time in the middle of all this, you might tend to think that maybe Moses had his own problems. Moses wants now to discuss the situation with the Reubenites. Numbers chapter 16, verse 12. Today's English version says, "And Moses sent for Dathan and Abiram, but they said, 'We won't come. I know you want to talk to us, but we don't want to talk. We don't feel the need.'" And verse 13. Now notice verse 13. And this is Moses they're talking about. And you and I know who Moses is, and we read the story. But you're kind of in the middle of all this back there, right? "You have brought us out of a fertile land into this desert to kill us. Why did you call me into that stupid church to begin with? I mean, look at what's happening here. You know, this thing's falling apart. We're not moving ahead like we wanted to, you know, and we can get to feeling. You just brought us out here to kill us." Is that why Moses brought them out? Well, I think we would all say, no, of course not. That was the accusation. "Moses, I know your motive. I know you say you brought us out here just because you're obeying God. You kind of didn't even want to do it to begin with. But you brought us out here to kill us. That's your motive. That's why you're doing what you're doing. You're a bad guy. And if you're sitting there in the desert, knowing that you weren't even going to make it to that promised land, do you think you might be swayed a little bit to kind of think, yeah, Moses isn't a very good guy. And now you want to order us around. It's all about power, isn't it, Moses? It's all about who's in charge. You just want to set yourself up so you can command the rest of us around." And verse 14, "And you haven't brought us into a fertile land. You haven't given us any land with fields and vineyards. You've really done us in here." So they accuse Moses of being a liar, of wanting power, and wanting to harm them. And it looks as though they kind of had a case. Not knowing God's perspective. The last part of verse 14, and it adds that little twist again. "Will you put out the eyes of these men? No, we will not come." you know, you put out the eyes of these men. A couple of different translations. Today's English version says, and now you're trying to deceive us. You know, you're giving your side of this story, and it's a deception. The message puts this. It said, you'd have to poke out our eyes to keep us from seeing what's really going on. You know, we know what's happening. We know what your motive is. Your motive to bring us out here to kill us, just to put yourself up as somebody big. Those accusations were there. And a lot of people bought it. And some of the accusations against them were true, which I'm assuming the one of building the golden calf might have been in there. Numbers chapter 16, verse 15. It says, then Moses finally responds to these accusations. It says, then Moses became very angry and said to the Lord, don't accept their gifts. I have not taken anything from them, not even a donkey. And I've not done anything wrong to them. God, what do I deserve to deserve this? All I was doing is what you wanted me to, and I get all this stuff. I'll give a little aside. Stuff is going around, and you know, as you know, I haven't gotten up to speak about, you know, and tell you all of this side of the story and all that side of the story and everything I know about everything. And had a couple of people in one of the church areas that said the reason he's taken that approach is because he's just in it for the money. And he's afraid to lose his paycheck. That's why I handle it the way I do, because I'm afraid to lose my paycheck. That's the accusation. I frankly don't appreciate it. You know, and I'm not mad at whoever kind of started that, but it's going around and people are saying I'm only in it because of a paycheck. I mentioned that to a friend of mine. He said, they don't know you very well, do they? nothing is new under the sun. And, you know, I'm not going to give you all the reasons why it's not true, but I could care less about a paycheck. I stand for, you know, what God would have me to do, and I will say what I feel that God would have me to do to help God's people through this situation or any other. I've quit my job because in the ministry before, because I wouldn't preach something I didn't believe. But it's out there, and for them, you know, he says, well, he's in it for the money. And he said, I haven't even taken anything from them, not even a donkey. And I expect that was part of the accusation. What have I done here? But people can say anything they want. And again, I say that as a caution, and I know it's a very difficult thing to work through and to think through, because yes, there are two sides to the story of what's happening with the church right now. And you think, well, if only I could read all sides, then I would really know what's going on. But you know, we tend to forget sometimes that when we hear a side, we very likely don't have all of the facts. You know, there are people that will make judgments on me because they heard that I'm only there for my paycheck. People will end up judging me in that way, and I guess that's okay. But it's a wrong premise. And what I'm trying to help us do today is be careful, because we can go on a wrong premise sometime. And I don't care. You can read whatever you want. I'm not trying to do what it says here. You'd have to poke our eyes out to see what's really going on, and if you think you can find out what's really going on elsewhere, that's up to you. But just be careful that we don't get on a bandwagon or on a side for the wrong reason, or based upon a rumor or a innuendo or a stated fact that may not be stated fact, or God may take another viewpoint of the situation. I'm just saying this as a caution. I'm not mad at anybody or trying to pull the wool over anybody's eyes or anything like that, but it's my perspective. Numbers 16, verse 16. Today's English version says, Moses said to Korah, "Tomorrow you and your 250 followers must come to the tent of the Lord's presence. Aaron will be there too. Each of you will take his fire pan or his censer and put incense in it and present it at the altar." And so every man took his fire pan and put live coals and incense in it and stood at the entrance of the tent with Moses. And so they're coming up to the big time, and they bring those incense, like they said, when God says, when Moses told God, you know, look, I'll just let people know what the deal is here. And verse 19, and then Korah gathered the whole community. He said, hey, I want everybody to come and see this. You know, Moses says that the truth is finally going to come out here. And so you come and see that the truth will finally come out here. And you'll see who's right. So he's very self-confident that he's right. And Korah gathered the whole community, and they stood facing Moses and Aaron at the entrance of the tent. Now, again, I think it's instructive to look at the attitude of Moses while this is going on. Your accusations are flying and all this type of thing, and he's pretty sure something's going to happen that they won't like. Numbers 16, verse 19 says, "Suddenly the dazzling light of the Lord's presence appeared to the whole community. And then the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, 'Move back from these people and I will destroy them immediately.'" You go for it, God. I'm behind you all the way. It's you and me, God. Now, carnally, I got to be honest, I'd probably feel that way. What I just said, you know, is that, okay, you guys, you go for it, God. That's what you want to do. I'm just a man under authority. I'm humble. And God, that's what you want to do, do it. Verse 22, it says, "But Moses and Aaron bowed down their faces to the ground and said, 'Oh God, you're the source of all life. When one man sins, do you become angry at the whole community?'" I think that speaks very highly of Moses. I think that speaks very highly of any leader who, even though people have just been after him, just a couple of verses earlier, he said, "God, what have I done to deserve all this stuff?" But yet when it comes down to it, he loved the people. He wanted the best for their welfare. He wanted to save them. And I think Korah is not the only one being tested here. I mean, I'm gathering that God is doing this and saying this to Moses and so forth to test Moses in a position of authority as he is Korah, as in a position of submission. And frankly, I think any leader ought to have this attitude. Does every leader have that attitude? No, I don't think so. Should every leader? Yes. Should every person not have the attitude of Korah? Yes. Does every person not have the attitude of Korah? No. I think God was testing Moses to see if he was humble and cared for the people. So to me, this is a story not just about Korah, but about Moses and a leader, whoever that is. Notice also that Moses isn't afraid to let God know what's on his mind. You know, God says, "I'm going to destroy them." And Moses said, "God, could you reconsider? I have a suggestion for you. I'm not trying to do your job for you, God, but could you rethink this a little bit and do it the way I would prefer that you do?" Now, he didn't say, "Well, God, you do it this way or I quit. I mean, you're just going to have to find somebody else to do this stuff because I think this is the best way you need to do it, and I'm kind of out of here if you don't." Moses didn't do that. But he wasn't afraid to say what's on his mind. And you go through with Moses, and oftentimes he intercedes even for the rebels. And God oftentimes responds positively and changes his mind about what he's going to do to the rebels. I think that shows, you know, what our attitude and approach should be. You know, do I agree with everything that the Home Office of the United Church of God does and the Council does? No, I never have. I can't say that in my 50 years in the church, and maybe there was a time, you know, when I was 10 or 12, but I really agreed with everything that everybody does because they're the guys in authority. I don't think so. I probably have in the past, but it's been a long time since I've just, yep, I agree with everything you say. Now, do I go telling everybody else what I disagree about and why I disagree and getting some people to join me so I'll feel better about getting a bunch of people to disagree? I have. And I've made mistakes in doing so. Stand before you as one guilty of doing much what Korah has done. I hope I've learned from that. This is a testing ground. And you know, when the volt goes through and it fails in an area, you kind of rethink and rebuild it and say, okay, what did we do wrong? And what do we need to do to make it better? That's what all of us should be doing, right? Now, Moses was not just a yes man who paid and prayed before God. But he also knew when to keep his mouth shut and just let God do what he was going to do. And there's a balance to that sometimes. I appreciate when people write me a note or tell me to my face or whatever and say, hey, I don't like this and I think this is what you ought to do about it. Or here's a suggestion, or you know, I'm frustrated, or whatever. I appreciate people doing that. I honestly do, and I'm not gonna, you know, if you've got an opinion, that's fine. What do we do with that opinion is what God wants to know. What's in our hearts? Do we handle it right? Moses had an opinion. Sometimes God says, "No, Moses, I'm gonna do this," and Moses said, "Okay." Sometimes God says, "All right, I'll back off. Good suggestion, Mo." Numbers chapter 16, verse 23. And the Lord said to Moses, "Tell the people to move away from the tents of Korah and Dathan and Abiram." And then Moses accompanied the leaders of Israel and went to Dathan and Abiram. And he said to the people, "I need you to step away from the tents." Step away from the tents. Get away from the tents of these wicked men and don't touch anything that belongs to them. Otherwise, you'd be wiped out with them for all their sins. In verse 27, and so they moved away from the tents of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. Who's missing here? On. Now, it starts off and it says Korah, Dathan, Abiram, and On came up against Moses. Now we find he's missing. What, did he already do away with him? No. He's missing here because it sounds like On, the son of Peleth, had a little change of heart. That he did, kind of like it says here, step away from the tents. You know, isn't a good idea oftentimes, especially when we get emotionally involved, because our emotions can be a big driver of what we do, to just step back away from the situation a little bit and reassess. You're going to say, okay, let's just see what God is going to do. Let's see how God is going to handle it. And I don't have to be right there at Korah's doorstep saying, yeah, you go, Korah. I like what you're saying. Step back. It's interesting that there's a Jewish tradition. It doesn't say anything else about On in the scripture here, but there's a Jewish tradition that it was On's wife who talked to him and had him reconsider. You know, when you think back at the circumstance and all the things we've been talking about and all the rumors going around and all the accusations flying about and all of the good guys that are involved in this and I'm on their side and all that, and On is one of the main guys. And On's wife says, you know, maybe you ought to reconsider that that may not be the best thing to do. Why don't you take Moses' advice and step back? You know, it could have been, you know, Numbers chapter 16, verse 12, and Moses sent for Dathan and Abiram, but they said, we will not come. Maybe it was that he sent for On, and On did come. And he went to the person involved and talked to him. I mean, how many times does that solve an issue that, you know, we hear something, and I've done that recently, and I've heard something, and I've gone, and I've talked to the council member that has had an accusation about them or whatever. And you talk to them and, oh, okay. I don't think I was getting everything there was to know about the story. I appreciate your input. And sometimes with the council, it's like, well, this was done in an executive session, and I frankly just can't talk about that legally or ethically. But I will tell you what I can, and here's a perspective, and you come away and think, oh, okay, well, that makes more sense. Now I understand a little bit what I didn't before. So he was wrong on. He reconsidered and became right on. And if you're looking for a sermon title, it's Wrong Cora or Right On. You know, we can reconsider. We can step back. Don't have to get in the middle of it and see how what God is going to do. Now, I know it's frustrating because oftentimes God doesn't do it as quickly as this. Okay, if God just would have taken care of that like 3 years ago, you know, we wouldn't be in all this mess. And he's not chosen to make it that clear, frankly. And he will. And it, you know what, it may not turn out the way we want either. But we have to look at ourselves individually and see if we're a wrong Cora or a right on. It's up to us. Numbers chapter 16 and verse 28. Then Moses said, this is how you'll know the Lord has sent me to do all these things. That was not my idea. If these men die a natural death and experience only what usually happens to men, then the Lord has not sent me. But the Lord brings about something totally new. The earth opens up and swallows them with everything that belongs to them, and they go down alive in the grave. Then you will know that these men have treated the Lord with contempt. And now we find a split in the church. Verse 31. As soon as he finished saying all this, the ground under them split apart. So we had a split in the group here. And the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them and their households and all Korah's men and all their possessions. And they went down alive into the grave with everything they owned, and the earth closed over them, and they perished and were gone from the community. And their cries and all the Israelites around them fled shouting, the sky is falling, the sky is... No, wait a minute. The earth is going to swallow us up too. Had their attention. But then these other people are looking at and said, this isn't fair. What happened to Korah and Dathan and Abiram? This really burns me up. In verse 35, and a fire came out from the Lord and consumed the 250 men who were offering the incense. 250 men fired in one day. Fired. What would you have thought of that? What if you would have been in Israel then and you saw all these guys you like? I mean, men of renown in the congregation. I mean, we liked them. We liked how they preached. We liked what they said. And now, fire came out from the Lord and consumed 250 men who's offering incense. These guys made a total ash out of themselves. Okay, I'll quit. Now, wouldn't you have thought that this was pretty unjust? I mean, what did they do? All they're doing is pointing out some of the facts about Aaron, about Moses, about what his motives were, about what he wasn't doing for us, about what he was doing to us. After all, they were just trying to do the work. They were offering the incense. They were handling the holy things as they were told to do. And it would have seemed, I got to be honest, if I were there, I probably wouldn't have reacted very well to it. Numbers 16, verse 36. Now to drive the lesson home, the Lord said to Moses, "Tell Eleazar, son of Aaron, the priest, to pull the incense from the burners of fire, for they are holy. Also to tell him to scatter the burning coals." Okay, there's a bunch of burning coals there, and there's a bunch of formerly men who are now ash. Scatter them. "Take the incense burners of these men who have sinned at the cost of their lives, and hammer the metal into a thin sheet to overlay the altar. Since these burners were used in the Lord's presence, they have become holy." It's interesting here that you find these guys doing the right thing God told them with the wrong attitude. It says these things, because they were using them to do the Lord's work, were holy. Are we doing God's work? Yeah. Can you do God's work with the wrong attitude? Yeah, you can. Any of us can. God's testing the heart. See, what is our attitude? And again, please don't think I'm assigning specific, you know, attributes to various specific people now. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about you and, you know, your approach and you know, to help you think about how God would have us to handle situations. Things to consider, at least. And yes, there are a lot of other things to consider, but this is one of those lessons. He said, take heed lest you fall. He took all these burners and he hammered them out, verse 39. And so Eleazar the priest collected the bronze censers and brought by those who had been burned up, and he hammered them out to overlay the altar. So he picked up these 250 censers and he started melting them down and banging them out, and he made this sheet metal. Any of you do sheet metal work? A little bit, but. Anyway, they hammered these things out, made a covering that was to go over the altar so that every time people came to the altar, they'd remember the story of Korah, Dathan, Abiram, and 250 guys that decided it's a good idea to join in with what they're doing. And verse 40, as the Lord directed him through Moses, this was to remind the Israelites that no one except a descendant of Aaron should come to burn incense before the Lord, or he would become like Korah and his followers. You know, there's always going to be somebody over you. You know, there's always going to be some line of authority, and that's okay. You know, it's not, authority is not a bad word. To Satan it is. He didn't like that word at all. We're all under authority. I mean, we're under the authority of the police, as Paul points out, of the government. We're under the authority of, you know, our children under our authority and so forth. It's not a bad thing. How we handle it has a great deal to do with how God is reading us and how he'll be able to use us in the kingdom when we are changed to spirit being. Well, it was a good story. I think everybody learned their lesson that from now on, you don't go against the established people. So I think you're a good lesson. Or was that it? Oh, wait a minute. Numbers 16:41. On the next day, all the congregation of the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron, saying, "You have killed the people of the Lord." these righteous, just, holy people, and Moses, you killed him. I mean, these same people that Moses, just the previous day, had prayed and said, God, don't take them out. God said, all right, I won't take them out. I'll leave them there for you. See what you get. You know, do you think Moses was frustrated? Do you think God's frustrated with the likes of us? And I include myself in that. God, I'm glad God just doesn't go around zapping me when I deserve it. Otherwise, you wouldn't have a preacher here, and some of you would appreciate if you would. Anyway. The implication, he says, you have killed the people of Moses. You have killed the people of the Lord. The implication of that is that Moses, you and Aaron are not the people of the Lord. They were the people of the Lord. What you have done to them is unjust. Now again, put yourself back there. What if your husband or father or whatever was one of those 250 well-liked men in the congregation who was just killed a little bit ago? Do you think you might have a little animosity towards Moses? Now, who killed him? Well, it was God. Why didn't you do something? You could have tried talking with them more. You had no right to fire those righteous men. Numbers chapter 16, verse 42. And so when this happens, we find, but when the assembly gathered in opposition to Moses, Moses and Aaron turned toward the tent of the meeting. Suddenly a cloud covered the glory, and the glory of the Lord appeared. And then Moses went to the front of the tent of meeting, and the Lord said to Moses, get away from the assembly so I can put an end to them at once. That was God that said he wanted to get rid of them. Now, if you don't like it, talk to God. Okay? It wasn't Moses doing. Moses, all he ever did was to plead, God, don't take them out. You know, and I know for me it's hard to get into to that. Just take them out, and in a human sense you do, and say, well, it's God that wants to take them out. And he told them, and what did they do again? They fell face down. Well, for one thing, you got to get below the lightning. You know, I don't want to be standing tall, you know, when God sends the lightning. Okay, there's a certain wisdom in that. But he went to the humble position, and so they fell face down. So you see what's happening here is God says, okay, I'm going to take these folks out. Moses and Aaron are there on the ground, you know, and they're sitting there, you know, like this, next to each other, kind of like Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, you know. And Moses said, verse 46, Aaron, take your censer and put incense in it, and along with fire from the altar, hurry into the assembly to make atonement for them. God just said he's going to take them out, and Moses still, showing the type of a leader he was and the love he had for those people. Again, this is not just about Korah's wrong attitude, but about Moses' right attitude and On's right attitude and whoever else had the right perspective. And so Aaron, he said, wrath has come out from the Lord and the plague has started. And so Aaron did as Moses said and ran into the midst of the assembly. Now, and I'm sure the people who, you know, with when Aaron's there, you know, with the incense and it's going around and it's saving them while the other people are dying, I'm sure that they appreciated Aaron's efforts. But I'm sure also there are people that said, Moses, couldn't you have sent a younger guy that could run faster? You send this 80-year-old guy out here running through the congregation to save us. Why didn't you send a young guy? You know, people, I'm just imagining that that's maybe what happened. Verse 47, so Aaron did as Moses, ran into the midst of the assembly. The plague had already started among the people, but Aaron offered the incense and made atonement for them, and he stood between the living and the dead, and the plague stopped but 14,700 people died from the plague in addition to those who died because of Korah. And Aaron returned to Moses at the entrance of the tent, and the plague stopped. God had had Moses to set up that covering over the altar to help people remember the lesson of Korah. And then the deal comes here where he's trying to say, look, Moses is my man, and you bring a staff from each of the tribes. And he said, I'm going to bud Aaron's staff. So remember, look, I'm working with a guy. And even if he also built the golden calf, I'm still working with a guy, whether you like it or not, and work with him. And what did he do with that staff that budded? What did he do? That's it. It's chapter 17, exactly. Yeah, it grew a bunch of, verse 8, the next day Moses entered the tent of the testimony and saw Aaron's staff, which represented the house of Levi, had not only sprouted, but had budded and blossomed and produced almonds. And the implication here is that as the people came in and it had budded, but then it also, before their eyes, starts producing. And God says, okay, does this help? You know, I know you're looking to know what's right and what's wrong and who's right and who's wrong, but here it is. And Moses brought all the staffs from the presence of all the Israelites, and they looked at them, each man at his own staff, and said, oops. And verse 10, the Lord said to Moses, put back Aaron's staff in front of the testimony to be kept as a sign to the rebellious. This will put an end to their grumbling against me. Yeah, right. So they will not die. Well, immediately, but didn't put an end to the grumbling against God and against Moses and whoever else ended up coming along. And then you read Hebrews 9, verse 3. It says, the Ark of the Covenant overlaid on all sides with gold, in which the golden pot that had the manna and Aaron's rod budded and the tablets of the covenant. He said, look, you got the Ten Commandments there. You got the manna that represents Jesus Christ and he being our Savior. And you got the commandments by which to live. And then there's also a reminder that talks about how to handle issues sometime, that how to think about it and how to not rush to judgment, to stand back and watch and let God handle things. The Chevy Volt was tested in the desert to prove the heart, coming out at the end of this year. And it will have been proven. Hopefully it's a pretty decent car. God is testing our hearts to prove us and try us before we move on into the kingdom. We look back at stories like this, and what group would we have been with, or where would we have stood when God said to move away from a divisive spirit? We must ask ourselves these questions. We are all going to be tested in this manner. You have been, you are being, and you will, because God wants to know if we learn the lesson of Korah, and whether we're wrong Korah or right on.